Let's go right to Gary. Gary is a professor in the Department of Agricultural Economics and Economics at Montana State University. He was raised on an irrigated sugar beet and malted barley farm near Laurel, Montana. And he has 2 degrees from Montana State and then finished his PhD in economics from North Carolina State University. His teaching responsibilities include farm and ranch management, agribusiness management, finance, agriculture marketing, and his applied research program includes livestock and grain, risk management, international trade, agribusiness, and farm management issues. He's currently managing editor of the Journal of Agriculture and Resource Economics and is sought out as a speaker on the topic that we're talking about today. And so we're really pleased to have Gary with us. And so, Gary, the program is yours. I'll be back when you're finished with a few questions for you. So thank you for joining us, Gary, and go right ahead.
Thank you very much, John. That was a very kind introduction, and I appreciate the opportunity to address this group. I've been reviewing materials that's been presented so far, and am quite impressed with the quality of presenters and the breadth of the conversations that have occurred to date. And when Duane asked me to do this talk, I happen to be working on a couple other talks. In fact, as soon as I'm done with this webinar, I head into Western Montana, which from here is a 5 or 6 hour drive, and be talking about some of these things to some producers on the western side of our state. One of the things that Duane asked me to do was give some thought to comments that were made a few months ago by David Cole, and maybe follow up a little bit with my perspective regarding the future for U.S. agriculture, and hence my title. There's always a future. The question is this a dim or a bright future? So with that, I will be referring back to some of the comments that David made, and again, who put out a very nice introduction to your entire series. And I will probably occasionally make fun of John Hewlett as well, just because that's something that I'm supposed to do on occasion. So as a quick outline, I'd like to talk a little bit about this concept of change. I know so much of the discussions that are occurring in the Ag in Uncertain Times curriculum is talking about, we often hear the word unprecedented change or previously unheard of volatility and things like that. So I want to talk a little bit about changing agriculture, talk about a real success story, and that is one of agricultural productivity. One of the things I do, increasingly that I do when I have presentations in the state to producers, is try to show them some things that they probably don't see because they don't have the time, or in many cases they don't have the fun that I do looking at data. And so for many of the extension educators who are like me, we look at lots of data and hopefully we get a picture that we can present to people that they don't have not seen in the past. Talk a little bit about recent commodity price behavior and a little bit about some things that I teach at Montana State dealing with strategic business management, a topic that often is not considered in the context of production agriculture and a topic which I think must be considered as we talk about the future of agriculture. And it, just in a nutshell, some of the things that I keep track of and add to my list of changes that appear to be occurring in the food and fiber sector. And again, none of these changes have never occurred in the past. It just they seem to occur pretty quickly and maybe more broadly than what we've seen in the past in production agriculture. I mean, think back to people that were raising grains prior to World War I. If they were on a farm today, they wouldn't have any idea how to produce a bushel of wheat. And so we've always had change. Maybe it's more rapid now, maybe not. But some of the things that have contributed to that has been really, really trade liberalization. And most of all of this has come about because of information technology. The technologies that John introduced me with and the technology that didn't work in my office is working in Duane's office, and it's working in many others. And all of these have contributed to, I think, advanced changes or advancing speed of changes. So certainly biotechnology, changing government roles throughout the world, have had an influence on how fast the food and fiber sector has changed. And when I talk to a lot of producers, you often hear the following. I hate change. I want things to stay the way they are or the way they were. Pick your decade that person felt like things were better. I'm always reminded of my mother, who grew up dirt poor on a farm and didn't learn enough from that. She married a farmer and continued to run a pretty good business after that. But she tells me, she said, well, the good old days might have been old, but they weren't all that good. And so whenever we think about change, a lot of change has been for the good. I'm reminded and often refer to comments made by General Eric Shinseki, who was the U.S. Army Chief of Staff in a very early part of this decade. And when he was talking about change, he was referring to military things because he was a great proponent of changes in the military. His quote was, if you don't like change, you're going to like irrelevance even less, because we don't have a choice with change. We either adapt or we get out. And it applied to the Army and to the military just like it applies to most economic issues as well. What has been the drivers of this change? Quickly, again, it's been documented by lots of folks, as I mentioned before. General technology, including biotech and information technology, but we shouldn't underestimate transportation technologies and packaging and food processing technology, which allow greatly improved shelf life on a number of commodities, which makes the world a smaller place in terms of producing food, and certainly in the case of fiber. A second primary driver of change has been population and income growth. In developed countries, we generally, even though we're in a recession now, we generally have much higher incomes than we've had in a generation ago, almost double a generation ago. This has put priorities into the areas of food safety and nutrition, convenience, and how things are produced, the processes involved, including processes all the way back to genetic material as far as that goes. Developing countries, again, increasing middle classes have increased demands not only for food in general, but especially for animal source proteins. So another driver of change. Trade and government involvement in agriculture, I'm lumping these together. Economies, especially developed economies, have found what developing economies have always known. Protectionism is expensive. New Zealand and Australia were one of the first groups to say we can't afford to do as much of this as before. The EU is saying the same thing. Canada and even the U.S. is feeling the bite of protectionism. And even without that, we were going to see increased competitiveness globally because of information technology. There just aren't many secrets out there anymore in terms of what's being produced, where it's being produced, and how much of it is being produced, coupled with transportation technological changes as well. My fourth driver of change that I like to talk to producer about is in the U.S., maybe worldwide, but certainly in the U.S., demographic changes. We now have lots of families with two incomes that tend to have enough wealth to demand more convenience and certain processes in their food. That's new in this past generation. We have single heads of households that lack both wealth and oftentimes they lack time as well, which influences the food sector to a large extent. Something that we tend to overlook, and we shouldn't be, because we hear of the problems of health care and Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, the increasing percentage of the populations that are in that senior category, we often forget that seniors' eating and health habits also change. And as we have a growing group of the population that are seniors, the food and fiber sector will be responding to that as well. And we have some changing demographics with respect to ethnicity, which has some influence on changing food demands as well. What are the implications of this change? Well, I've come up with probably two ways of thinking about what farms and ranches of the future are going to look like. I think there'll be two types. I think we're going to see the traditional commodity producers that are using new technologies, advanced technologies at work. They're going to continue to strive, and I'll talk more about this later, to be low-cost producers. They're going to be thinking about high volumes and low margins. They probably are going to be the bigger producers, and as John Hewlett will be visiting about later, and then I see later on with the strategies in terms of managing risk, these folks are going to have to be very savvy at managing both their price and production risk, which you always have to do in a high-volume, low-margin industry. The other type? I'll just call them generically value-enhanced producers, those that are going to be focusing more on expanding margins. This could be through identity preservation, through the development and sale and production of specialty products, maybe things that will have nutraceutical or certain animal welfare attributes that people are willing to pay for. Some people are willing to pay for perhaps low input, meaning less use of chemicals or organic, something like that. What are these folks going to have in their toolkit to manage that risk? Well, they're going to have very strong marketing and entrepreneurial skills. They're going to have to be good at negotiating, and they're going to have to be good at trying to share risk with others and be very involved in market coordination issues with the people that they have lined up to be part of that particular supply chain. Food systems, then, are restructuring as well, and they've been doing this for a long time. A little bit less reliance on commodity markets as we look for specificity in terms of how things are produced. Probably means increased contracting. And one of the side effects of this appears to be some higher concentration in the food processing sector or in the logistics sector, any of those sorts of things. And I think we have to think about that when you have that higher concentration, there's going to be lots of concern about whether or not this is generating market power, which what we really mean is negotiating power. Are we providing more ability or will concentrated processors have the ability to negotiate more severely with providers or not? But we also know, and plenty of our research has shown, that there is also efficiencies for much of the concentrated industries, and that we have trade-offs between these two issues. It probably means for many producers less independence and doing things just the way they want, more concern about the process and keeping track of and identifying whether it's cattle ID, whether it's process-oriented identification. We're going to see more of that. Probably some chance for more risk sharing amongst adjacent sectors. And then we always have the issue of who's in control when we have that linkage between production and the processing sector. I have a question mark behind that because we often don't know, and it's often specific to the particular situation. So after all of this restructuring and all the changes we've got going on, what does the ownership of farms look like in the U.S.? This is from the U.S. 2007 Census of Agriculture. And what you find is not much change, at least in terms of farm numbers. 86-87% of farms and ranches in the U.S. are still owned by families or individuals. There is some family corporation that are often incorporated for estate planning or tax reasons. There are some partnerships, about 8%. Many of these are family partnerships. Some could be limited partnerships as well. Now, in terms of volume, I suppose other corporations would generally have larger operations than most of these families or individuals. But even if you do this on the basis of sales, the pie doesn't look much different. And another thing to think about is after all of this change and as we're going on, what do returns in these industries look like? I've taken the agribusiness sector here and broken it into production agriculture, food processing, wholesaling, and food retailing. And over the 10, 11 year period that I'm showing here, the return on assets by industry is almost identical across these industries. Now, agriculture is right at the top there, or very close to the same as the others. In agriculture, of course, some of that return on assets includes inflationary aspects that are related to land, whereas with food processing, if I have a sugar refinery, it doesn't appreciate in value, it depreciates. So the source of those returns are slightly different. But nonetheless, economics would suggest that resources would move into areas that have high rates of return relative to those of low rates. And this is exactly the kind of thing that we would forecast if we're just starting from scratch. People will move those assets in and out, and there's been a fair bit of similarity among returns throughout these sectors on average. Now, let me talk real quickly then about agricultural productivity, because the productivity in agriculture over the last century has been almost four times that for the general economy itself. And the way to think about this is take a look at all the output that is produced by U.S. farms and ranches. I say farms a lot, I guess, as John mentioned. I'm from a farm, and I tend to use that vernacular more than ranches, but I'm meaning farm and ranches here. And what I've got is two lines on a chart here. This is just an index of the output of U.S. agriculture since 1948, the blue line, the top line. And if we just take because we have to add up bushels and pounds and all these sorts of things, you put it into an index and call 1948 our base, we can see that U.S. farm output and ranch output has increased by 2.5 times. Now, one way that we can increase output is by increasing the amount of inputs we use, land, labor, capital, all those sorts of things. Yet, when you look at the input usage over this time, it's the brownish line there, and it's almost dead flat. We use the same amount of total quantity of inputs today that we did in 1948, and we produce 2.5 times more output. Tremendous change in farm productivity. Again, one of those drivers that I mentioned a little bit earlier on. Now, while the amount of inputs that are being used are very similar, the composition of those inputs are quite different. My slide 19 here shows, again, using an index approach, that the most striking thing here has been the increased use of chemicals, including fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides. This is the brownish line towards the top. That has increased very quickly through the Green Revolution in the 60s, sort of flattened out a little bit through the 80s, and has now seen an uptick throughout this decade, the end of the 90s and throughout this decade. Mechanical, really, we had this strong increase in the use of mechanization into about the early 1980s, and since that time, we've seen less. And again, that makes perfect sense. We have increased energy costs in general, and so people have substituted away from that. Plus, with the increases what we've had in labor costs, again, moving away from labor-intensive things to other means for producing things has been a major shift. If you look at the labor line, which is the most striking line here, the green line, we're using 20% of the labor today to produce all this output relative to the end of the 1940s. What has been the results of the productivity? What has caused the productivity change? The results of research and adoption of technologies has been tremendous changes in crop yields. Since 1950, soybean and wheat yields have now doubled since that time, and corn yields have gone up over 4 times. So when we think about productivity and where it's come from, it's reflected then in those crop yields. And the livestock sector has not been too far behind either. I calculate each year what I'll call the productivity of the U.S. beef cow breeding herd. And by taking how much carcass weight of pounds do we produce for every beef cow that's out there, we see that back in the 70s, this is almost a measure of weaning weights, almost, essentially. Back in the 70s, we were having a 500 pounds, 450 to 500 pounds of beef produced for every beef cow out there, and today that number's up near 700. So we're getting close to almost a twofold increase during that time as well. Why? Better genetics, better nutrition, animal health, all of those sorts of things, rebreeding rates, all those sorts of things have tremendous productivity changes built into them as well. Now, one of the things I do want to visit about, and again, it's pretty much the focus, I would think, of this seminar series, is on commodity price behavior. John Hewlett's going to be talking about Duane's work and his work and others on how you manage risk. And we can talk about production risk, which I know is a topic, Duane, as well. Duane and I are in the same office now, so I can look at him for some confirmation from time to time. But to be doing some production risk, but there's also the price risk element as well, which I know is a major topic of this seminar series. And of course, there is variability in prices. I just happen to have corn and wheat prices on slide 23. Back to 1909, I like to look at historical data, sort of fun. And you see wheat prices and corn prices, they bounce around a fair bit. And this is a part where I want to stop for, or slow down just a minute and talk about why that happens. Because David Cole was visiting with you, and he has one perspective on why this happens. And I would say that I'm going to disagree with that, but that's okay, because I wouldn't be an academic if I didn't at some point disagree with somebody else. And so as an academic, I'm going to say that we see some variability in prices. And, of course, recently, very high prices, and I expect that we'll be back to a trend price in just a bit. Now, let me talk a little bit about the idea here of variability in these prices. David had mentioned that there were some mega cycles or trends or something like that occurred in World War I and then somewhere around World War II. And certainly World War I and World War II were responsible for some price increases at those times. There's no question about that. But then he'd mentioned that we had the Korean War and we had the Vietnam War and we had the Middle Eastern, Iraqi sort of war and Kuwait and all these sorts of things. And the reality of it is that these later green circles, these rise in prices, are not caused by political factors or anything like that. I mean, every time I've had a green circle up there, I'm sure the New York Yankees won an American League pennant sometime in there anyway. They had to have. They won so many of them. And we know that didn't cause those higher prices either. The reality of it is that economics can explain most of those price increases. I'm not saying that economists can predict them very well, but we can certainly explain them. David had mentioned an interesting, he uses this a lot in his talks. He argues that 80% of economics is actually psychology, that's what drives these markets. And I just beg to differ. I would agree. I would think that about 80% of psychology can be explained by economics, because incentives matter a lot. Even the insane respond to incentives. So I think a lot of psychology could be explained by economics. I don't think the converse is actually true. Let me talk a little bit then about why we see these price swings. We tend to think about these price increases that have occurred at various times, as noted by David. This, other than for World War I and World War II, economics provides the fundamental explanation for why we see these periods of above average or below average prices. And it's stuff that we teach and learn in our principles courses at the sophomore level in economics. We have relatively inelastic demands for food and agricultural commodities if you're graphing this relatively steep supply demand curves. And when you have relatively small changes in world production, that can trigger large changes in price. That's where the variability comes from. When I said economists can't predict these swings, it's because we can't predict the weather. If I could, then I wouldn't tell you, by the way, any of you, because I can make a lot of money from this. But it's really a function of weather and, to some extent, some changes in demand, especially as we've seen corn demand increase because of ethanol production. But most of the time, demand for most of these commodities is relatively stable. Supply shocks cause most of these swings that we see in commodity prices. And of course, this is a good thing, right? We when we have high prices, it tells us we don't have enough stuff around, and it encourages people to produce more of it. And the converse is also true. Low prices are telling us there's too much stuff around, and the market doesn't want as much, and people will respond. Now, how does this help us then think about long run? I mean, this is, John, when you introduced me, and I was thinking about long run price expectations. I expect to see short run high prices occasionally. I expect to see short run low prices. But over the long haul, commodity prices are going to gravitate towards the average cost of producing a product. We say, why would that be the case? Well, because when commodity prices are above the average cost of production, there's profits to be made. It invites entry. High prices, higher profits in any sector invites more people to join. My brother became a corn producer 3 years ago. Why? The price of corn was heading up. He wasn't a new producer of he was not a new farmer, but he certainly jumped into the market when he had the appropriate signals. High prices invite entry, low prices encourage exit. And as a result of that, we will enter and exit an industry, and commodity markets in the long run, the best you can hope for on average, will be what economists call normal returns. Normal returns are those positive returns that are just high enough to keep you in the industry, to keep you from leaving the industry, and to not encourage more entry. That's the long-run equilibrium we're going to expect in commodity markets. So I think we can do a good job of forecasting what our long-run price expectations. Now, as we then think about the average cost of producing a bushel of wheat, we can also make the forecast that real or inflation-adjusted commodity prices are going to decline over time. Why? Well, commodity products by definition are undifferentiated. The only competitive strategy that a commodity producer is going to be able to use, because it is an undifferentiated product, is to be a low-cost producer. And to become a low-cost producer, one has to adopt those technologies that I talked about before. As everyone adopts better technologies, we lower unit costs of production, and prices, because they're going to gravitate towards those unit costs and generate those average returns, is going to cause us to have declining inflation-adjusted commodity prices. This is certainly a good thing for consumers, okay? And for producers, it's a challenge. Let me give you a quick example here. I said I like data, especially historical data. Back, this is U.S. wheat prices, slide 27, starting in 1866. And for, I don't know, what is that, almost 80 years, we had a price that sort of jimmied around a dollar, got up in World War I up to $2, and then got back down. And since that time, nominal wheat prices have trended upward since about the 1940s. Now, what I want to show, and whenever I show this to producers, producers are quick to mention, and they're absolutely right, yeah, Gary, the prices have gone up, but so have my input prices, fertilizer, fuel, seed, labor. And I said, absolutely right. So let me take that same series and deflate it. Let me take inflation out of this picture, and those producers are absolutely correct. Inflation-adjusted commodity prices have declined. By the way, that's true for computers, that's true for calculators, that's true for airline transportation, and over the long haul, it's also true for oil. Because of definition of commodity prices, technological change will cause this to happen. Now, what the flip side of this story then is wheat yields since 1866. And those wheat yields were kind of around 15 bushels an acre until after World War II. And I showed some yield data earlier. This is just putting this into a longer time series. Certainly yields since the Depression have been going upward on wheat and even more so on corn. Now, here's what I want to do. I want to take the inflation-adjusted price for wheat and multiply it by the yields that we get for wheat. So I'm going to take out inflation and add in, which puts a downward pressure on inflation-adjusted prices, and then we have the wheat yields, which is the production that's coming off of an acre of wheat. And when you do that, you get, again, some variability, which what this conference is all about, in inflation-adjusted revenue per acre. Inflation-adjusted price times yield. And, of course, it jumps up and down because of weather and price changes and all those kinds of things. But here's one of the most remarkable pieces of data that I've uncovered as I've worked on this problem. And that is, what is the trend in revenue per acre in wheat? So I took a linear trend line and just ran a regression and fit it to this data. Take a look at the data. Can you see what's going to happen? Maybe not, but my question is the trend up or down on revenue, inflation-adjusted revenue per acre? And we're looking at 142 years of data here, okay? The pink line, slide 31, shows the trend, and there is no significant slope coefficient on that trend line. Folks, the trend is dead flat. 142 years, and revenue per acre adjusted for inflation is still the same as what it was in 1866. If I had to forecast the future, I'd say the next 50 years, the pink line will prevail. Why? For the discussion I've just completed regarding commodity production. If we're way above that trend line, more people will get into the industry, will drive the price of wheat down. If we're below it for too long of a time, people will move out. And even if demand goes up, if that increases the profitability in that industry, we will have entry. I think it's one of the most remarkable things. By the way, we could do this for corn. Cattle's a little harder because the product has changed. But if you take any commodity that you can adjust for quality, you're going to see exactly the same behavior in the data. What do we learn from that? What are the management implications then? Well, agricultural producers operate in one of the most competitive sectors. In fact, that's what we use in our classrooms. We talk about agriculture as one of the closest form we have to perfectly competitive markets. Now, agricultural producers often don't perceive themselves in competition with their neighbor, unlike the beef packing companies who consider themselves in competition with their people, or Cargill versus Bungie or any of the other grain companies. They don't perceive themselves in competition, but they certainly are. This is why agribusinesses in general, the Cargills of the world, are not really interested in being agricultural commodity producers. The best they can hope for is a normal rate of return. They can't keep entry from occurring. And so that's not a very attractive, strategically, a very attractive business to be in. For any producer, then, to earn above average returns, they've got to be one of the low-cost operators in that particular line of work. And this provides a huge role for price risk management. John will be visiting about this, John Hewlett, in a little while, but my story to producers out there in the in Montana and in the rest of the country is, you know, when we see a record price, you really ought to take it. It's not going to last forever for all of the reasons that I've talked. It's not about psychology, it's about supply and demand. And wheat prices have been very high for 2 years because we had 2 years of pretty poor world production. We've had 2 years of good production, and now they're low. I'm reminded of a very successful wheat farmer that I saw at a restaurant one day, and I walked by him and I said, how are things going? And this was about a year ago, and he goes, just my luck. He says, price of wheat's $14 a bushel and I don't have any to sell. And I looked at him and I said, that's because you sold it all at 12, and that's a heck of a price. And he laughed and smiled and said, you're right, it's buying dinner tonight at least. So when we see record prices, folks, we want to take advantage of those. I very often, John Hewlett, I know Dwayne gets the same sort of thing, and all you extension educators out there, whenever prices are low, we usually get people to call us and say, will you come out and tell us how to use the futures market to get a better price? Well, that's a nice thought, but it doesn't work that way. That's not what the futures market is for. It's to manage risk. And if you've already got a low price, you don't have to worry about it going much lower. So we don't have much help in those times. Let me sum up this particular section, and then that this provides some context for our current situation. Commodity market prices are certainly below recent record levels, but they remain above the long-run average, and they will always be trying to get towards that long-run average. The question becomes, will they be below a long-run average price for a long period of time, or will they be above? And it all comes down to, have we had anything that has permanently influenced demand? And I think we have for corn. I think we will now see $3.50 corn more than $2 corn because of increased demand. But on the cost side, have we really seen any fundamental shift in what the long-run costs are for producing a commodity? If we have, then I would predict that our long-run prices will rise over time, but not to a great extent. The best you can hope for is to run the race and end up in a tie. David Cole did a nice job of explaining some of the use of trends for evaluating land purchases, and he very carefully cautioned everyone that whenever we start thinking we're going to see a $5 corn price forever and we start buying land based upon a record price, we are setting in motion all sorts of huge problems. That is, if you're going to borrow money to purchase that land based upon those trends. So we certainly want to use trends. And as David was mentioning, it's the repayment capacity that's based upon these unrealistically high prices that cause the problem. So we need to be thinking about the trends that I've laid out here. Where do we really think prices are going to be over the time it's going to take to repay the debt on that particular land? So Dave did a nice job of laying that out. Let me work through in just the next, I got a little bit of a late start here. We're still okay, Duane. The last couple things, the role of strategic business management. And I've talked very much about a lot of this already. In these competitive markets, entry and exit of firms will cause these industry to earn normal returns. Yet within every industry, some firms will earn below average returns and some above. The industry is going to do average. Why do some firms do better than others? This was a huge undertaking by Michael Porter at the Harvard Business School about 20 years ago, who pioneered the concept of strategic business management. And he said, what determines that difference? Why are some above average and some are below? And there's all sorts of things. Luck. Luck's a good thing. I've noticed that good managers tend to have better luck. But I think whenever you can use, you know, have good luck, that's a great thing. Along with luck, one might add, it's always good to pick your parents well. I tell my students this all the time. If you want to be successful, just be a Rockefeller. You have a good chance of having some success then. I always consider marrying well to be a really good thing to do, too, for a number of reasons. But that's another way to maybe help out on the success. But beyond those two, what about other things? Well, you know, innovation and capitalization, taking care of debt structures, your management expertise and your attitudes and ability to manage risk becomes important, along with our selected management strategies. So let's think about the management strategies. Successful firms pick one of three strategies that leads to a competitive advantage. Either they're going to be a low-cost producer in order to outcompete their neighbors, they're going to be producing a differentiated product or a focused strategy. Again, all of this from Michael Porter's work. A low-cost producer is just got to be that firm that's going to be a low enough cost producer that they can survive those times of low prices. Maybe a producer of commodity beef, for example, would be an example of someone who tries to be a low-cost producer through the adoption of technology, increasing productivity, managing both costs and risk as well. Typical strategy employed by commodity producers in agriculture. Second strategy is a differentiation strategy. That is, producing some product that's truly different. Perhaps an example in the beef industry would be either a certified Angus beef product or something that's widely distributed and accessible. Maybe it's a differentiated strategy based upon convenience or consistency, service, those kinds of things. Not typically used by ag producers because differentiation is both costly and it's risky. A focus strategy is the third identified by Michael Porter, and this means just concentrating on a specific or a niche market. Maybe as an example of beef industry, a Laura's lean beef or any of the narrow branded products that exist out there. Again, increased dependence though on either single source suppliers of inputs or single source providers of your output are another source of risk that I know John Hewlett and Duane are visiting with people about throughout this program. Bottom line, what's the best strategy, Gary, if you know so much? Well, the answer is I don't know. It depends upon the industry in, your ability to handle risk, your skill set. I do, however, know the worst strategy. The worst strategy is not having one. Michael Porter called it being stuck in the middle. I can't outcompete anybody in any area. I don't produce a different product. I don't have a skill that I can use to help market that product. And I'm not a low-cost producer. Those folks end up with below-average profits. Final section here, Duane and John Newkirk, just a couple more quick things. I'm going to be speaking later today on this topic. Is there a future for agriculture? Well, there's a future. I think the question is there a dim or a bright future for U.S. agriculture? And quite frankly, folks, I say grab your shades. I mean, we have so many advantages and so many opportunities that I think the future is quite bright. In what way, or why do I think brighter, and what way do I mean bright? I mean, we're going to continue to have the opportunities to receive normal profits on average over the long run in all of these industries. But in addition to that, we have private and public research efforts that have tremendous improvements in productivity and efficiencies. We have tremendous institutional strength in the U.S. Strong property rights are essential for a productive economy. A stable political environment. I know we think that we don't have a stable environment, but we've only had one civil war in the last 300 years, and that's one too many. We have an economy that allows us at least to function, and that's something that many, many countries don't have. U.S. has fantastic infrastructure, as do many other countries, by the way, but we have the really strength in the financial institutions that we have. Yeah, we've had some problems. We didn't have enough regulation in some of these. I don't think there's any question about that, but overall, credit can be obtained. Risk management opportunities exist for both production and price risk. We have tremendous research and education that all of you folks are involved in one form or another. None of this is by accident. This is a function of market-oriented systems properly regulated with strong property rights. I think one of the things that we can't lose sight of is that firms have to be able to keep some of those profits to compensate for risk-taking. If we tax all of those profits away through a variety of things, we lose incentives, and I think that has very strong implications for productivity. Who has that bright future? Those that have a strategic advantage, those that produce commodities and are able to generate low-cost advantages through size or technological change or some sort of efficiency. In the case of my dad, he obtained this by getting rid of me and making a capital for labor substitution. There's another source of efficiency. Or we're going to see differentiated or focused producers who need to be excellent entrepreneurs. Duane and I know of Wheat Montana, the Dean Folkford's operation out here, where he's raising his own high-protein wheat. He's baking it. He's making bagels. He's selling bread all over the state and into the region. Wonderful situation, something I could never have done. I went to school with Dean. He's tremendous entrepreneur, works tremendously hard. There are going to be opportunities for folks like that. It takes a special set of skills. So with that, Duane, I hope I haven't gone too long, and John Newkirk, but I'm at the end of my set of slides, and I hope this provided you with something that you can think about. And we're going to ask questions now, Duane. Or?
Okay. We'll take some of them have similar. And one of the first ones is you identified what you thought are advantages here. And the question was, how can domestic producers remain competitive with imports given the regulatory environment that they face?
Yeah. An excellent question. We will have a disadvantage when it comes to regulations. But I'm convinced we offset that to a certain extent because of food safety and quality control and how we produce. I mean, ultimately, consumers do care about that, especially in developed countries. For those countries that don't care about those things, I think we will continue to struggle in those markets, and they're just not going to be the markets that we're going to want. So I argue that, there are some advantages in these other countries, but most of these countries that don't have the same regulatory environment as the U.S. also don't have the infrastructure technologies as well. Remember, wheat can be produced in a lot of places. And so if it's a lot cheaper and a lot easier and a lot less expensive to do it elsewhere, we would do a lot more of it elsewhere. Again, these resources do move around. I think we have enough evidence, John, that we can compete. It's always harder, though. Don't get me wrong. But in some sense, those regulations can be helpful in terms of consumer confidence. Can we overregulate? Absolutely.
You mentioned kind of three aspects: commodity, low cost. You mentioned focus, which I interpret as value added. So, is there a future in value added market approach to commodities?
Well, absolutely. But I think we have to be careful in terms of value added. What we're meaning here is there, can I do something better by creating more value in a product than somebody else? And let me explain that. We have a processing system in the beef sector that is able to do that much more efficiently than individual farmers can do it and small local processing plants. So on the one hand, you have to ask yourself the question, what aspect of value added, what is going to be the competitive advantage that I'm going to create? I'll go back to Dean Folkford in Wheat, Montana. Again, I did a quick overview of that, but it's pretty easy to find on the web. We have tremendous examples of people that have taken a lot of risk, but they've been excellent entrepreneurs who have gone all the way to the consumer in terms of taking wheat and making bread or taking beef and making a steak. There's lots of examples of that. The point I want to make is that there are niche markets or focused or differentiated markets for all of those kinds of things, but they're often not very large and not everybody's very good at it. Let me give you an example. My brother raises a variety of irrigated crops. The last thing that he wants to do is be closer to the consumer. Because he's a bad guy? No, it's not his skill set. He has no interest in that. He's really good at producing the commodities that he produces, and he knows that. He's been, in a sense, forced into being closer to the consumer through a cooperative effort because he raises sugar beets, and he's a member of a sugar beet co-op that owns the factories. One of the greatest sense of risk that has been heightened has been that he's had to put investment into something that he no longer controls, that he has to depend upon other managers and things, and he's very close to the consumer, and he's the kind of guy that doesn't like it very much. So I think we have to be careful when we say value added. It always sounds like that's got to be a good thing. But when we say value added, and John, I appreciate the question, and you certainly, and most of us do, think about this, we not only mean increasing the total revenue from an operation, but we have to also recognize that that also is going to have an increase in total costs. As economists, we certainly understand that if the revenue isn't going to go up more than the costs are going to go up, the value-added component is not sustainable. So there are opportunities. There always will be. There always has been. But it's not for everybody, and we can't have a Wheat Montana operation and bakery in every county in this state, nor in any of the others.
And we've got one last question, Gary, and then we're going to move on to John Hewlett. And it's how do you think that the ethnic composition of the U.S. population and the shifts and change that are going on will impact ag and markets?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, one of the major ethnic shifts, of course, has been Hispanics. Hispanics are traditional high protein consumers, and I think it does change the type of beef products that are going to be demanded. So I think in particular, the beef industry and the pork industry have to be thinking about how do they position their products to meet some of those tastes and preferences that we're talking about in terms of the changing ethnicity composition. And we're primarily talking about a bigger proportion of the population being Hispanic. And I think we have to think a little bit more about what does that general group want in terms of convenience? Or is it different? I don't know, John, but those are the kinds of things I think the beef, pork, and poultry industry have to be thinking about. Is there a significant change? There may be no difference at all, but it's something they need to investigate.
Well, Gary, thank you very much. I don't know about the rest of the audience, but I really enjoyed your presentation and the information you provided. And drive careful as you head on out into further into western Montana. I guess my image is Bozeman's western Montana, but there is quite a bit left to the west of that. So
there is, John. Thank you so much for your comments and for inviting me here. And I just want John Hewlett to know that I'll be listening to his presentation later on when I get back. So I want you to hold his feet to the fire a little bit.
We will do that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.